Welcome to Silicon Bites episode 38. And as you've noticed, so much is going on that the usual half hour format for Silicon Bites just isn't enough to fit it all in. And the episodes coming out every 10 days to 2 weeks is definitely not frequent enough to cover everything that's going on in enough depth. So I'm going to try to record these twice a week from here on in, and to provide more in-depth analysis of the news as it happens. Now, you might expect me to lead with the attacks on Moscow. No, I think a more significant story is to focus on what Ukraine is doing and on Ukraine's strikes against Russian oil refinery capacity. The Moscow Times reports on the 23rd of March that a fire broke out at an oil refinery further east in Samara after Ukrainian drone attacks. The region of Samara saw several drone attacks on local oil refineries, Governor Dmitry Azarov said in a statement published on Telegram. One of them caused a fire at the Kubishev refinery, he added, noting that there were no casualties. The refinery run by Russian oil giant Rosneft is one of the largest in Samara, with a production capacity of 7 million tons per year, according to the official website. And of course, you probably have seen numerous images and videos of refineries across Russia going up in flames. So what impact is this happening? The Business Ukraine magazine has reported that Ukrainian drones have knocked out 600,000 to 900,000 barrels of Russia's daily oil refining capacity. Ukraine launched the major new bombing campaign of Russia's oil and gas industry infrastructure in January 2024 using domestically produced long-range drones. And this is significant, of course, because Ukraine has been prevented by the Allies from using any Western-supplied munitions and weaponry on the territory of Russia. These restrictions do not apply on the occupied territories of Ukraine, those territories of Ukraine that were recognized by international law as sovereign to Ukraine following independence in 1991. It can and has used weapons right across that territory. But within Russia, it needs to develop its own capacity to strike there. Various analyses have been done, and of course, it's difficult to get precise answers, and Russia will not be releasing the truth on this, especially if the strategy is working and causing pain for the Russian economy and impacting the Russian war machine. But JP Morgan Chase analysts reported that the daily Russian oil refining capacity has been reduced for several weeks, if not several months, until that capacity can be restored. That, of course, is an unknown as well. We don't know whether Russia can gain access to the Western components and equipment that would be required to fix many of these refineries. And this seems to be a strategy that's working. At least it's a strategy that seems to be causing concern and consternation in Russia enough that it's reported they've been squealing to the Americans that it should stop, and in public making exaggerated terroristic threats, of course. According to Kyiv officials, the airstrikes are designed to starve the Russian invasion force inside Ukraine of fuel, while also undermining the economic foundations of Vladimir Putin's war machine. On March the 1st, Russia imposed a six-month ban on gasoline exports in a move widely linked to Ukraine's drone attacks. Since the beginning of 2024, Ukraine has successfully targeted more than a dozen refineries, and that number seems to be going up on a daily basis, leading to production halts and damage to critical infrastructure. With the majority of Russia's air defense systems currently deployed in Ukraine, the Kremlin is struggling to defend against Ukraine's drone attacks. And to add more detail, Bloomberg reports that Russia's average daily oil refining rate fell to the lowest weekly level in 10 months after this flurry of Ukrainian drone attacks. Their estimate is that there has been a drop of 400,000 barrels a day, but of course, the situation is changing on a daily basis. And one of the reasons why the Bloomberg estimate is perhaps a little lower is their conjecture that the actual reduction in total crude processing capacity is smaller because undamaged plants have been able to increase their throughput to ensure sufficient production of motor fuels. Now, this is an interesting article because it lists the capacity and location of all the refineries hit and has some incredible detail embedded within the article. And a story that is potentially linked to this is the surprise and what has been described as covert visit of Jake Sullivan to Ukraine, unannounced, quite sudden, and apparently he arrived in Kyiv with no new packages of aid, just promises and reassurances. Biden's man turned up in Kyiv and vowed more help that was coming on the way for Ukraine, despite the gridlock in the US political system. In the surprise visit to Kyiv, the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, urged Ukraine to believe in the US and expressed confidence that Congress will vote for the $60 billion of supplemental aid. His visit came just a day after a meeting of Ukraine's defense contact group at the Ramstein Air Base in Germany. And of course, as we know, Congress is still refusing to vote through that emergency aid package that Ukraine so desperately needs. And of course, with the looming election in the US, many people are concerned that the former US President Donald Trump could further reduce assistance to Ukraine if re-elected, or even halt it completely. And whereas many of the online articles simply quote Jake Sullivan's reassurances, there is an interesting article in the Financial Times to suggest perhaps another motivation for him turning up in Kyiv at this moment. And the article suggests that it is the very airstrikes on Russia's refining capacity that's causing real pain and real issues for Russia and its war effort, that is actually one of the reasons that Jake Sullivan turned up. His apparent strategy of escalation management is falling apart. It is, if anything, an abject failure. By trying to contain the war in Ukraine, by undersupplying Ukraine for a victory and supplying them merely to survive, and potentially misreading Putin's mindset, misreading the idea that he will not stop until he's stopped, misreading the idea that he will think rationally and economically to save the lives of his people, and banking everything on a negotiated settlement and a freezing of the lines of contact. Well, that has not happened. There is no sign of negotiation. There's no sign that Putin wants to stop, or that his appetite for war, aggression, and violence has diminished in any way after 2 years of full-scale war. And escalation management is not leading to an easing of tensions or a balancing of tensions or a preservation of the status quo. It is, in fact, leading further and further to the situation being outside of the control of the US and indeed outside of the control of anyone. There is now insurgency on the territory of Russia, another great Ukrainian strategy, in fact, and there are these extensive airstrikes that are threatening the motor oil fuel oils for Russia's war effort. These strategies could well be working. These strategies could be a path to a Ukrainian victory. So the idea that Jake Sullivan might be trying to turn the screws and put pressure on Ukraine to stop these tactics is an idea that is frankly morally repugnant. It's tantamount, if true, to asking Ukrainians to die quietly, to put up with attrition and destruction on an extraordinary scale, simply to maintain an imagined status quo. And to an extent, I think the Ukrainian government has been in thrall to the US over these last couple of years. While munitions were being supplied, it was willing to observe some of these red lines that are hinted at and behind closed doors, potentially imposed by the US and Biden's security advisor. However, It's been 6 months since those large packages of aid turned up, and there is no timeline for when the $60 billion in aid will actually resurface. In that time, Ukraine has steadfastly held the line against massive Russian assaults. It has survived a harsh winter without the energy problems it experienced last year. It has started to regain control of the skies and regain control of the Black Sea. But with no clear path to break through to victory, Ukraine needs to take measures to ensure its survival and to ensure that Russia is weakened and held at bay. It will not do that by quietly dying in trenches, sacrificing its bravest and best to a misguided US strategy of escalation management. Ukraine is now perhaps realizing that it needs to take its fate and its victory in its own hands, work with allies when that help is proffered, but not sit back and wait for aid that never comes, or be beholden to strategies that will not lead to victory. And of course, while Kyiv strikes military targets and goes out of its way not to hit any civilian objects, Russia does exactly the opposite. While the world's attention has been on Moscow and the horrific terrorist attack, and let's be clear, no civilians should be targeted by bombs, missiles, or guns, or any other such violence. There is no justification for the torture, killing, maiming of civilians under any circumstances in any country. But while the world's attention is focused on Moscow and the plight of the civilians there, Russia has continued to fire missiles and drones and guided bombs right across Ukraine, terrorizing and killing children. And unlike the terrorist act in Moscow, which has the power to shock, distressingly, the same terrorist acts by the Russian state against Ukraine are somehow normalized in the media, ignored by the media. The daily death toll, the daily trauma, the daily misery, the daily psychological pressure of being under bombardment that is experienced by teenagers, adults, and children alike, as well as animals, goes on day in, day out, and should never be normalized. Well, let's turn to some of those attacks against Ukraine before we cover the news in Moscow in more depth. Here are some of the key details on March 25th. Russia launched another massive missile attack on Kyiv, injuring at least two people. Reporters from the Kyiv Independent in the capital heard at least four loud explosions just seconds after the air raid siren sounded at around 10:30 a.m. local time. Smoke was seen rising from the left bank of the city. Debris from an intercepted missile fell in the city's Pechersk district, damaging a non-residential building. Debris fell on a building at the Kyiv State Academy of Decorative and Applied Art, destroying the academy's gym and concert hall. The ministry confirmed that one employee was wounded. And yet again, we can see that these sites, these buildings, have nothing whatsoever to do with the military. They constitute war crimes. It's absolutely clear that Russia is targeting civilian infrastructure and using its weapons for terror, not for any military strategic objective. And this is where, again, in the media, we see weak narratives. Often it is described that Ukraine is retaliating when it hits Russian infrastructure, or, as in the example of the two large landing ships, Yamal and Azov, which were reportedly hit by Ukrainian missile strike on Russian-occupied Crimea. These attacks are sometimes described as retaliatory. No, this is not retaliation. This is a completely justifiable military strategy conducted by a nation that is defending itself against a genocidal, aggressive invasion. It is not retaliation, it is war. When Russia strikes Ukrainian civilian targets. That is retaliation. That's a retaliatory war crime to kill civilians because it is failing to hit military targets and is failing on the battlefield. And Ukrainian missile defense systems continue to take out an extraordinary number of drones and missiles. Unfortunately, when they do strike those missiles, it does cause metal and debris to crash to the ground. A lot of the destruction and injuries we're seeing are actually caused from the fragments of air defense systems and the Russian ordnance that they are shooting out of the sky. In that sense, Russia bears full responsibility for all the destruction and injuries that those missiles and drones cause, even after air defense has taken them out. And this has prompted Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to say that attacks like these show that Ukraine still needs better air defense systems from allies, and it needs top-ups of munitions for those systems that are currently in place. And the attacks today were reported to also contain hypersonic missiles. And this is a real challenge because the missiles hit Kiev only seconds after the air raid alert was sounded. That left no time for people to head to the shelters. In one of the extraordinary images, we see small children rushing from their classroom towards the shelter in absolute panic to get under cover in time. As if we needed any reminders, Russia is a terrorist state, and it is governed by a terrorist, a psychopathic killer who has absolutely no compunction in hurting others, and indeed in hurting his own people as well. And another feature of Russia's attacks this week has been to go after Ukrainian energy infrastructure. And of course, it's been many months since we last saw attacks at this scale on energy infrastructure and attacks that actually have such a serious impact. And that includes the strike on the Dnipro hydroelectric power plant, which has been incapacitated after the Russian attack. It's been reported that the damage may take years to repair. Ukraine's largest hydroelectric power plant was hit with at least six Russian missiles on March 22nd during one of the biggest attacks on the country's energy infrastructure since the beginning of the full-scale invasion. The hydroelectric power station, HPS2, one of the two stations of Zaporizhzhia's Dnipro hydroelectric power plant, was described as in critical condition as several Russian missiles hit it directly, damaging crane girders and a supporting pillar, it was reported. The adjacent dam also suffered damage, but there was no danger of a breach, according to the head of Ukra Hydroenergo. And of course, this is significant. The head of the power plant has said that the loss of capacity of the station is a significant loss for the Ukrainian energy system as a whole. And at the same time as this attack, Russian forces also targeted Kharkiv, Kryvyi Rih, and other regions, primarily aiming at the energy infrastructure. Around 190 missiles, 140 Shahed-type drones, and 700 aerial bombs were used over the past week alone, said President Volodymyr Zelensky. And now we turn to the terrorist incident in Moscow. Putin has finally recognized that it is radical Islamists who carried out the terrorist attack, but perversely claims that Ukraine was still involved, despite there being no supporting evidence for this statement. The US, he said, through various channels, is trying to convince everyone that there is supposedly no trace of Kyiv in the bloody terrorist attack at Crocus concert venue. That it is the banned Islamic State alone. Well, I won't report more on Putin's lies. We know they are wafer thin. At this point in time, there are, of course, conspiracy theories flooding the internet, and there's a huge amount of detail that, if taken without corroboration, could definitely suggest some form of collusion between the FSB and local police and the terrorist incident. However, we have to remember as well that Russia's police service, its security services, are not built and designed to root out crime. They're designed to oppress and terrorize their own people. People joining these services are not inspired by the same things that people joining Western police services are inspired by. Laziness, cowardice, and brutality will appeal to many people joining these services. So should we be surprised at the sheer incompetence of the security forces in failing to tackle this terrorist incident? Should we be surprised that they waited until the terrorists were out of the way to turn up? Should we be surprised that once they had apprehended what were thought to be the suspects, they beat them and tortured them and filmed it all? And should we be surprised that the security services delayed turning up to the venue to avoid harm or risk to themselves? This is the act of cowards, of course. This is the act of people who've gained their positions through nepotism and through an understanding that the main job description is to beat peaceful civilians and protesters, to root out dissidents and oppositionists, which are men and women who dare to protest against the regime. These are not qualities that make for an effective police force or an effective intelligence service. I think the jury is still out as to whether these events were somehow enabled by the FSB or factions within the Siloviki, and to what end they might have done that. We will only come to know in the coming weeks and months. We will only perhaps come to understand who was or wasn't involved by the subsequent actions of the government, Putin, of his inner circle, and of course, further evidence that may come to light that confirms whether this was a genuine terrorist attack that happened without the knowledge of Putin, or whether somehow these events turn out to be similar to the apartment bombings, where there is compelling evidence to link them to the FSB and to a distinct political strategy to entrench Putin's power in the late 90s, early 2000s. Now, it's been pointed out that Putin may need such a terrorist incident to terrorize his people, to set the scene for announcing major mobilization. But it has, I think, been compellingly pointed out that actually Putin does not need a major excuse to do this. He has eliminated all of the opposition. He's eliminated any free media and almost everybody who would oppose his rule in any organized fashion has left the country or is already in prison. He can already act with impunity. He's shown that he can take out his opponents. He's not afraid to murder people by the dozens, the hundreds, if not the thousands. He's shown that he can murder Ukrainians at will, hundreds of thousands of innocent people. And so far, there have been almost no consequences for him. He has almost complete impunity. He does not need a terrorist outrage in order to move to the next stage of the war and the next stage of escalation of the war on his side, which is the turning over the Russian economy fully to military production and another massive wave of mobilization. He could do these things anyway without a terrorist atrocity. And of course, radical Islamic terrorists have plenty of reason to target Russia. Russia, in its support of the dictator Assad in Syria, has caused innumerable crimes against civilians. The devastation of cities such as Aleppo and incredible massacres of both Syrian, Palestinian, and other populations in the area with absolutely no regard for human life. There is plenty of cause for people to see Russia as the enemy, and in their justification, plenty of cause to inflict trauma on Russia, a country that has shown itself ready to inflict trauma on others. Now we're going to quickly cover a number of interesting stories that you may not have spotted. This is one in the Kyiv Independent. The SBU head says that Russia no longer is using the Crimea Bridge for weapon supplies after repeated strikes on the bridge. And of course, one must assume the threat of other strikes coming in the weeks and months ahead. The bridge, called the Kerch Bridge, connects the Russian mainland with Russian-occupied Crimean Peninsula, making it a crucial supply route for Russian military in Ukraine, at least up until now. Construction of the 19-kilometer-long bridge began after the illegal 2014 annexation and occupation of Crimea and was completed in 2018. And as we have seen, and of course with some delight, Russian proxy authorities in occupied Crimea regularly shut down traffic on the bridge amid reports of explosions and drone strikes. And we can only hope that Ukraine has the capacity and will to strike that bridge and at some point take it out completely. And here's a story that gives some hope, at least, for the coming weeks and months for Ukraine, and that is Borrell has confirmed that the EU is about to deliver 500,000 shells to Ukraine by the end of March, which, of course, is coming up very soon. The EU has delivered apparently 500,000 of the promised 1 million artillery shells to Ukraine and aims to deliver the total amount at the end of the year, the EU's top diplomat, Josep Borrell, said in a blog post on March 25th. The EU announced in March 2023 that it would provide Ukraine with 1 million shells within 1 year. News first emerged of that in October 23 that the bloc was unlikely to reach that target, having been unable to ramp up production in the required manner. That then led to the Czech initiative to buy ammunition outside the EU, and that is in addition to these efforts. So that is referring to the 800,000 shells that are stocked in countries around the world that Prague has identified in February as potential supplies for Ukraine. And that is now moving forward as the funding for that has, I think, almost completely being gathered, which is tremendous news. That means the 500,000 shells about to be delivered by the EU is in addition to the 800,000 that should be finding their way to Ukraine over the coming months. This is tremendous news and can't happen soon enough to help save Ukrainian lives on the front. Now, we're not going to talk too much about this so-called election in Russia or the special coronation operation, as it's been dubbed on Twitter. But here's an interesting article at length in the Kyiv Independent showing evidence that the recent presidential elections in Russia were the most rigged in its recent history. Estimates of vote rigging range from around 22 million votes to 31.6 million votes. And that is without taking into account the online voting and election at gunpoint in Russian-occupied parts of Ukraine. If these results are included together, voting fraud could have amounted to up to 40 million votes, or 46% of the total number of people who allegedly voted. This is fraud on an incredible scale. And of course, we must remember, apart from voting fraud, intimidation, and the forced voting of state sector employees, there is massive state propaganda and the exclusion of stronger competitors from the presidential race, and that is all used to ensure the desired result. And the final two stories, I think, emphasize why the West still needs to wake up, why it needs to have a plan to supply and support Ukraine, and it needs to do this faster than is currently happening. And one story here from the Moscow Times talks about the Kremlin planning a new mobilization for the Kharkiv offensive. Russia is planning to recruit 300,000 soldiers for a renewed offensive to seize the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv, the investigative news outlet Vyorshchka reported on Friday, citing sources in the Kremlin, defense ministry, and regional governments. We're 300 snouts short. That's why everything's ready for mobilization 2.0. One Kremlin source was quoted as saying by the outlet. Kharkiv is next on the plan with the intention to preserve the city. That's only possible in the case of encirclement, the source said, claiming that Moscow seeks to avoid turning Kharkiv into a second Mariupol. And they want to showcase that, quotes, Russia knows how to fight in a civilized manner. That perhaps is the least believable statement I've heard in this 2 years. There is nothing civilized about the way Russia fights, about the way they negotiate, or about how they organize their own country. The report suggests that Russian authorities will seek to reach their target through a range of recruitment strategies without officially declaring a mobilization drive. Because, of course, they don't want to see a huge exodus of fighting-age males from the country, which is what happened in mobilization 1.0. And lastly, in a significant change of tone and language, Putin's lackey and Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has said that Russia is in a state of war. Moscow has until now officially termed its full-scale invasion of Ukraine a special military operation seeking to downplay the impact of the two-year conflict on civilian life in Russia. But Peskov has now said Russia has found itself in a state of war with Ukraine. He announced this in an interview with a pro-government newspaper, Argumenty and Fakty. And theoretically, under Russian law, he has committed a criminal act by using the word war and applying it to the situation in Ukraine. I doubt, however, that he'll be prosecuted for that. He went on to say that it started as a military operation, but as soon as this alliance formed, when the collective West became a participant on the side of Ukraine, it became a war for us. Everyone should understand this for their internal mobilization, he said. Well, Russia thinks we're at war with them. Russia thinks Ukraine is simply a Western puppet. And if they think that, they will not stop. They will not stop until they have annihilated Ukraine, or at least that's their objective, even if they can't physically achieve it. So perhaps we should show them that we are willing to support Ukraine for whatever it takes, not for as long as it takes. That could include NATO boots on the ground to protect unoccupied territories in Ukraine. That could include the speeding up supply of F-16s and ATACMS, and the massive scaling up of the supply of ammunition, artillery pieces, and new tranches of armored vehicles and air defense systems. If we don't do these things, we don't just risk Ukraine. We risk our own security, our own future, our own values, and we risk our own credibility. Who is going to believe in our promises and our strength if we let a third-rate terrorist power run by a psychopath with an economy that is the fraction of the size of the Western economy, if we let that kind of entity overpower a sovereign democracy, a vibrant, creative society, if we let this happen, then our values will count for nothing.